KNOM, AM, and FM in Nome. It is now 1 o'clock.
Inviting all you folks in Western Alaska to stay tuned to KNOM, Radio 78 in Nome.
Hi, welcome to the Ocean Knowledge Radio Show, a show featuring news about our ocean, from science to policy, climate, shipping, and indigenous knowledge. I'm your host, Megan Anders, today with Davis Hovey.
Thank you, Megan.
Ogivumururunga, Sabiktunga, the Alaska Ocean Observing System, as the Director of Ocean Engagement. We're honored to join you today. Together, we will understand what is happening on our ocean and discuss the ecological and geopolitical changes that make our homeland. We will hear from agency managers, scientists, and indigenous knowledge experts. It's my hope that we are empowering residents, hunters, fishermen, and fisherwomen of Western Alaska with knowledge, updates, and news on what matters to our way of life. On today's show, we will share what management decisions are on deck for the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council and discuss the council process, highlight research that is going on in our waters, and hear from Sylvester Ayak, a hunter, a King Islander, an artist, and indigenous knowledge expert. Hi, Sylvester. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
You'd like to introduce yourself? We're honored to have you with us.
Wanga anayorunga ugiwuk miwurunga suksadun unalu.
Alrighty, so thank you, Megan, and Koyana, Koneanakpuk, Sylvester. So as you mentioned, this is the inaugural show of Ocean Knowledge, and I think before we jump into a full interview, did you want to share some Inupiaq vocabulary first, Megan, or should we go to Sylvester, or what do you want to do first?
Well, I will try, and Sylvester, please correct me. So we're going to learn what the Inupiaq word for water is, a body of water, or ocean. It's Imaq.
Imaq.
Imaq. And Dariuq.
Yeah, Dariuq is another word for Imaq. They're interchangeable.
Thank you. So if you want to remember those words, Imaq, Dariuq, we're going to be discussing the ocean today.
Very good. All right. So should we transition to our questions here, our interview with Sylvester? I'm going to kick things off. As an expert ocean navigator, what kinds of things, sir, do you pay attention to? Changing currents, the wind direction, Inupiaq weather predictions?
Mostly wind is a big factor. You know, using small boats in northern Bering Sea for all of the hunters from this area.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And so on that, What wisdom, what guidance would you share with young hunters in the region?
For many years, you know, we've been using small boats all along the coast, all the way up to other hunters, you know, further up north, safety is utmost important. To be aware of your surroundings, you know, when you're out in the small boat.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And what do you do for safety on your on your own boat when you're out in the ocean?
I think, you know, for many people from our island, we are seafaring people. And it's a almost like being in second nature to us. And but if you use if you are aware of your surroundings, you know, and the weather, you always come home. Right.
And that's always the goal. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. Megan, I think you're up.
Can you share with us the types of ice you navigate and what knowledge about the ocean was shared with you when you were young?
Yeah. By springtime hunt, the ice is broken up and scattered and start going towards the Bering Strait. With the current, and scattered ice is called Dumalina. And today, you know, that has changed so drastically for us because of global warming. We had to be very aware of ice conditions when we're out hunting. Because, you know, the ice is not as thick as it used to be. It was not uncommon to see 6, 7, 10 foot of ice. And we'd be very lucky to see ice that is at least 6 feet thick, you know. Mm-hmm. Because of global warming, you know, the ice has shrunk quite a bit. Mm.
Sylvester, on our last trip to King Island, you were cliff climbing for mer eggs, and it made me realize we have to be expert rock climbers on King Island, fearless of heights, and truly believe in our mental and physical capabilities to live. Do you have tips for staying healthy, both physically and mentally?
In King Island, you know, being physically fit was no problem. And because, you know, that the all around the island is about 45 degrees to ocean level. And a lot of sheer cliffs, you know, where we climb to gather eggs and bird hunt. Mm-hmm.
And what about now, though? I think kind of to Megan's question, do you have tips for staying healthy physically and mentally when you're not on the island, like when you're here in Nome?
Well, I suppose, you know, staying physically fit is important to all the hunters, you know, is that we have to exercise, you know, walking on the tundra, for instance, is the best exercise, you know, to stay in shape. And how I did it when I was younger was that I ran almost every day, you know, for 30 years. And that's how I stay fit. And today, I leave the hard work to a younger crew.
And what's your fastest time to King Island?
Pardon me?
Sylvester, we know you are a fast boat driver.
Yeah.
What's your fastest time to King Island from Nome?
We can make it there probably about 3 or 4 hours. And from the nearest point that is Point Spencer, we can usually make it less than an hour.
Wow. That's amazing.
That is. All right.
We've been on some other journeys together. When I was 10 years old, Sylvester and other boats of King Islanders made our way all the way across to the Russian side. For you, what was that experience like?
It was a heartwarming experience to connect with our brothers and sisters across Bering Strait. The Siberians there were very welcoming. And the Russians were understanding. And it was a very good gathering where we exchanged our way of drumming and dancing. And that was really awesome. And thank you to your dad, Jim, who spearheaded that trip.
Koyana, were there differences of life that you noticed with the Eskimos on the Russian side or the Inuit on the Russian side that were different from how we lived, or what was your observations?
I think, you know, what I noticed right away was that they don't have as much freedom as we do on this side. And the hunters were even regulated, you know, how many shells, you know, they can take out on their hunting trips. And so I think, you know, we can be grateful, you know, that we have so much freedom on this side to do anything we want.
Beautifully said. Sylvester and I are big fans of Mary Peltola, and so we've been elated in the last few days that she's our new congresswoman-elect for Alaska, and so he wanted to make sure we gave her a shout-out. Davis, do we have any questions as we come to the last few minutes here?
No, I don't have any more specific questions, Megan, but thank you, Sylvester. It's been a pleasure speaking with you today.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you. It's an honor to have you with us, and we hope to see you on the ocean.
Thank you.
So we're going to transition then to our next guest, but I think before we do that, Megan's got a little cue for us, and this is a walrus and seal sound from the ocean, so we'll play that here.
The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council manages the fisheries in the federal waters off of Alaska, up to 200 miles off the coast of Alaska, in what is known as the 200-mile exclusive economic zone. The council is one of 8 fishery management councils nationwide that were established by Congress in the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation Management Act of 1976. The council is made up of 15 members and has a staff of analysts who help facilitate a public process of decision-making. It is a gathering of council members appointed by the Secretary of Commerce, of fishery industry organizations from across the state, CDQ groups from Western Alaska, as well as scientists and researchers on the forefront of ocean issues. There is a rhythm to the agenda of the council each year, and the jurisdiction of issues is vast, spanning from the Gulf of Alaska to the Bering Sea to the Arctic Ocean. Issues like protecting ecosystems, climate change impacts, and bycatch are revolving agenda items. Joining us over the phone to help unpack this process is Kate Hapala. She serves as a fishery analyst and the rural community and tribal liaison for the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. Welcome, Kate. We're honored you can join us.
Hi there, Megan. This is Kate. Let's just make sure you can hear me loud and clear.
Yes, You're on air.
Well, thanks for having me today.
So if you can share with us how the process works and how the council is incorporating local and traditional and subsistence knowledge, which is something relatively new for the council process.
Sure. I'd be happy to talk about that. In terms of how the council's process works, you mentioned just how the council is responsible for making management choices and recommendations for fisheries in U.S. federal waters between 3 and 200 nautical miles from shore. And the council meets 5 times every year, typically in February, April, June, October, and December. And these meetings are held in person, and then there's also a virtual component. So folks are interested in paying attention and listening but can't travel. They can watch live over YouTube or participate directly over Zoom. And 3 of the 5 meetings are held in Anchorage each year, 1 in Seattle or Portland, and 1 in a fishing community within Alaska. And the council meetings typically last 9 days, so they are a long haul. If folks are interested in participating and attending a meeting, the schedule for each council meeting can be found online, and we post those several weeks in advance of the meeting. Schedules can change for several reasons, so it's always best to double-check whether there have been changes to the schedule. But if you're interested in following one particular topic or agenda item, what you could expect is that at the meeting, council staff would introduce the agenda item, and then the council would receive a presentation on the issue, then take up public comment so they have all of the relevant perspectives and information prior to their deliberations and determining what kind of action they would want to take. And oftentimes people get involved in order to make a change to one small part of their business or way of life, but that could take a long time in the regulatory process, usually requiring 6 months or more in order to analyze the issue, deliberate, and then implement the federal regulations to make those changes. But there are opportunities at every step of the process for the public to provide their input and make sure that their perspectives and views are heard. And I think the second part of your question, Megan, was how the council considers local, traditional, and subsistence knowledge. And you're right, that is a new part of consideration for the council. So much of the council's decision-making has been based on Western science over the years. But that's only one way of making sense of the world around us, and the council recognizes that. So in 2019, it formed a nominated body of Alaska Native elders, traditional knowledge holders, local knowledge holders, subsistence hunters and fishers, and social scientists like myself to really consider the council's process and make recommendations on how to appropriately and respectfully include local, traditional, and subsistence knowledge in its process. And so this nominated group really does understand that subsistence hunting, fishing, and gathering activities are deeply connected to history and culture and tradition. So part of this work has emphasized relationship building and trust, understanding that that happens slowly over time. And sometimes this work occurs through the working group that we've got, and other times it's through outreach trips to communities, among other things. So the council members were up in Nome and Unalakleet earlier this summer. Other times, local, traditional, and subsistence knowledge that's recorded in reports or other publications is included within analytical documents to support decision making. And in these instances, that knowledge helps the council to consider social and cultural impacts of their potential decisions and management actions.
Thank you, Kate. Fishing in our communities is part of our native way of life, our homelands. It is a process from catching to cutting to drying to freezing, and is part of what defines us, how our families work together to put fish away, how we share and trade with relatives, and how we sustain and feed ourselves from season to season. So I have a question for the audience. This is an interactive show. If you have any questions or comments, the Number to text is 907-317-7052. And we want to hear from you who makes the best dry fish in your family. Let's give a shout out to our providers if you want to text their names and where they're from. I want to give a shout out to Cameron Akbiak of Teller and Giminuk Maddie of Nome. They've shared their catch with me, as well as Ian, Elvana Stimple, and Nina Stimple, who's also shared with me two bags of dry fish. I won't say whose is better, but we want to hear from you. Again, that number is 907-317-7052.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you, Megan. Yeah, thank you, Megan. So I think, Kate, thank you again for the information. And I'm going to kind of set this question up with some information before I ask it. So as you may or may not be aware, we have some amazing halibut commercial fishermen in Savoonga on St. Lawrence Island in our region. They fish on 20-foot Lund boats and pull by hand halibut out of the Bering Sea. I think of Perry Pungawi, who I spoke with a couple years ago, and many others out there who are doing great work. So they participate in a legal fishery that requires services by the federal government that are often hard to come by on St. Lawrence Island. So if you're listening to the show right now and you're a commercial fisherman in Savoonga or outside of Nome, obviously you can register your boat at a DMV location here in Nome or in Anchorage. But there are also crew registrations with federal and state agencies for captains and crew. So my question to you then, Kate, if I were a fisherman in Savoonga or even Unalakleet, subsistence or commercial, with limited internet access, what would be your recommendation for them to plan to participate in MPFMC meetings? How would they go about doing that?
Sure. That's a great question, a really important one that's at the heart of the council's process. So I would say the first step is to think about which of the council's actions may be affecting or impacting fishermen's way of life and try to find that intersection between the things that folks care about and are concerned with and something that the council might be considering. And then I would say get involved in our process, and there's a lot of ways you can do this. So first, there's the council's website, www.npfmc.org, and that has the name and the contact information for every staff member and for every council member. And so reach out to the Alaska council members and staff that you think can answer questions and talk with you about your issue. And you can always learn more by talking and visiting with folks. Come to a meeting. You can participate in meetings. All of our meetings are open to the public. If traveling isn't an option, you can always watch the council meeting live on YouTube, which is low bandwidth when you're considering internet. Our meetings are also recorded, so if you missed a day or the entire council meeting because you're busy with other things, then you can go ahead and get those recordings and listen to them on your own time. Of course, fishermen can provide public comment as well, so there are several ways that you could do this. First, you could provide written comments, so writing a letter prior to the meeting and sending that in. You can address that to the council chair or the executive director, and this, of course, requires no internet at all, and our admin staff can post that letter to the council's meeting agenda. And then you can also choose to submit written comments electronically directly to a council meeting agenda, and that comment portal on the agenda page is much like writing a Facebook post. And then, of course, fishermen could also provide oral comments to the council. So if you are at the meeting, you can sign up and give your comments orally when it's your turn in the order, and the chair would announce that. And if you can't be at the council meeting in person, that's no problem at all. You can provide oral comments over the virtual platform, which right now we use Zoom. And you don't need internet in order to connect and to provide your comments. You can use the telephone number to call in. So that's a lot to say. You know, fishermen should always feel free to talk to council members and staff, provide written comments, oral comments, come to a meeting. And if you do come in person, at the front of the council room is a staff table, and we're there to help folks get connected and and sign up and answer any questions that folks might have.
Thank you, Kate. Is there a number that people can call at the North Pacific Fisheries and Management Council if they have any questions in general and follow-up?
Sure. So I think if folks visit our webpage, every staff member has their direct line that's listed and a description of the issues that they work on. So folks should always feel free to reach out to the staff member that works on the item that you're concerned with, and then, you know, get in touch with me too. And I can provide my number, which is 262-358-2927. And that's my cell and the best way to get a hold of me. And feel free to give me an email too. And my address is Kate, K-A-T-E dot Hapala, which is H-A-A-P-A-L-A at NOAA, N-O-A-A dot gov. So that's a great way. And if you visit our website as well, there's a contact hyperlink. And if you would rather provide your questions or just reach out to staff that way, that'll go to an email address. And our staff will be able to take a look at what those questions are and get the right person to reach out to you.
All righty. Well, thank you again, Kate. Appreciate that so much and the information. And again, that phone number, if you missed it, for Kate directly, Kate's number is 262-358-2927. And that is Kate Hapala, if I'm pronouncing your last name correctly, hopefully. But yeah, thank you, Kate. I'm going to just plug kind of the upcoming meeting, but one of the specific dates that people should be aware of is the nomination openings for appointments. Could you just mention those dates real quick?
Sure. So, Davis, I think you might be mentioning the nominations open for the new Salmon Bycatch Committee. And if that's the case, the council is accepting nominations for that committee up until noon on September 30th, 2022. So if you are interested in serving on that committee, feel free, please send your nomination letters, including your background and a statement of interest, to npfmc.admin@noaa.gov. And again, the nomination period is going to be open until noon on September 30th.
Excellent. Thank you, Kate. And yeah, a reminder, that's the MPFMC seeking nominations from Western Alaska for the Salmon Bycatch Committee. So if you know of someone that you think would be a great fit for that committee, make those recommendations via email. As Kate just mentioned, you can send a letter or... I guess we can also give you a call directly, right, Kate, if we have questions about that?
Yeah, sure thing. Feel free to give me a call or send a note.
Excellent. Thank you, Kate. And again, those appointments, the deadline to submit nominations is noon, September 30th, and those appointments will be announced later in October at the MPFMC Council meeting. And I think that will about do it for us. If you have any questions at this point about MPFMC, Kate is a great resource for you. And we're going to move on to our next guest in a little bit, but we can take a quick music break if you want there, Megan. I think we've got Ukilla up next, Byron Nikolai, here on KNOM.
Alaska Ocean Observing System collaborates with federal agencies to track ongoing research efforts in our oceans and seas. The Interagency Arctic Research Policy Committee helps manage the sharing of objectives across federal agencies doing research in the Bering Sea and the Arctic Ocean. The agencies include the National Science Foundation, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, the Department of Interior, the U.S. Coast Guard, the Navy's Office of Naval Research to compile federally funded research occurring each year in Alaskan waterways. Before we jump into and highlight some of the research vessels this summer, we have a text giving a shout out to the yummy dry fish from Ramona and Roger Nussick Jr. in Koyuk. Awesome. It's awesome to hear how much we share dry fish with one another, and all of our families across the Bering Strait are fishermen and fisherwomen. So keep texting. The phone number is 907-317-7052. So we've had a few vessels come through this summer, among probably 40 or so. We'll just focus on three. If you have seen some sail drones in the Bering Strait, this is a project funded by the National Aeronautic and Space Administration, or NASA, to measure sea surface temperature. The drones are measuring sea surface temperature in order to validate or confirm sea surface satellite data for the purpose of understanding what influences water temperature in the southern Bering Sea. So anyhow, I learned that this morning. I thought NASA doing work in our region was pretty incredible. Another project ongoing is, which is a project funded by the National Science Foundation and the Government of Canada. It has created five biological observatory sites that were set up this July, starting with the southwest end of St. Lawrence Island, the south side of Diomede, and the southern Chukchi Sea. Scientists are hoping to understand the biological response to sea ice retreat and observe ecological shifts in fisheries production. From what I have asked of our on staff scientists at AUS is, what does all that mean? And it means they're observing, with the warming ocean and the changing chemistry of the ocean, what is happening with the biology and the mammals and the fish that are there. And so they've set up these sites and they're observing what is happening. So we'll hear more from that in the future. Davis?
Yeah, thank you, Megan. Sorry to leave you talking there for a while. We've got our third guest coming up in a little bit. But yeah, in terms of research crews, updates, and other things going on in the region, the Norsemen, another interesting project. This is a project funded by the National Science Foundation. So the Norsemen 2 is currently surveying the presence of harmful algal blooms in the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas. Right now, we understand this cruise is making its way from the Barrow Canyon and will dock in Nome. And if you are not familiar with harmful algal blooms, we talked a lot about them on KNOM and in various circles, but they're also known as red tides, and that's the algae in the sea that have toxins that are potentially causing paralytic shellfish poisoning. And there was a recent release from Norton Sound Health Corporation that put this out, and then also I see this is an IARP collaboration, IARPC, excuse me. Release that, and that's the document from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and they kind of have the details there about the cruise log, checking into different points earlier this summer, and some really good information about HABs. But that's actually what we're going to talk about with our third guest, who's here already in the studio, so we're going to cue her up, and maybe hear one more seal walrus sound transition there before we come back.
Thank you, Davis. Another shout out for yummy dry fish stored in seal oil is Matilda Davina. Thank you for that. That sounds delicious.
Alrighty.
Before we jump into our science feature, a discussion on harmful algae blooms, I want to acknowledge and recognize Opik Akinga of Diomede, who has led an amazing citizen science project since 2020. To monitor blue king crab, phytoplankton, ocean acidification, and harmful algae blooms. Her project is funded by the BIA, and she continues to seek out funding opportunities to keep it ongoing. She is a reminder of how amazing our residents are in leading the way of what science should occur in our ocean and what science is meaningful to our way of life. And so we are really honored to have another local hero here in the studio with us to help us understand what the state of harmful algae bloom is and what the science is. Gay, if I may ask you to introduce yourself.
Sure. Thank you. Good afternoon, Megan. And I'm really glad to be in KNOM once again. So harmful algae, that is the topic. So you want me to sort of go over what it is and where we are?
Yes. Thank you. What are the ocean conditions going on in the Bering Sea that are giving us the rising threat of harmful algae blooms?
All right. So first, what is harmful algae? Algae is just basically, at the smallest level, are just one-celled plants. And we need algae. The ocean, we would not survive on this planet without algae. So there are many, many different kinds. And a few of them produce their own natural biotoxins. And when those occur in a great quantity, we can have problems. Some of those toxins affect people, mammals, and our seabirds. So people have been looking for harmful algae. Oh, and I just want to say that when people talk about a harmful algae bloom, bloom just means a period of uncontrolled growth. So those little cells will split in half if conditions are right, and then those cells will split in half, and those cells will split in half. So you pretty soon can have a quite a large number of cells of harmful type of algae very quickly. So there's so many ways to hit this, but from the science side, in 2016, there was a study that was published, and it looked at feces or UNNOC and was looking at what marine mammals had eaten and whether or not they had gotten a concentration of – they'd eaten something that had concentrated the algae. So, for example, if you had lots of good algae and a little bit of the bad algae, you'd be able to pick up like if a clam or a upa or tunicate – or crab filters out the water and is eating algae for a living, they're going to have a load of algae in their stomach. If it's good algae and we eat that clam or the bearded seal or ugruk eat that clam, no big deal. But if the clam has been sifting the ocean and the ocean has a harmful algal bloom, meaning, wow, now all of a sudden we have a type of algae that is bad for us, that clam or that upa or tunicate is going to concentrate it in its belly. It is not harmed by it at all. And they're just going to sit there and eat it. But if you're the walrus or the bearded seal and you come along, or the person, and you come along and eat that clam, it has a concentration now, very dense, of an algae that may be producing a poison that will affect us. Thus, you eat that clam at the wrong time when it's full of harmful algae and not good regular algae, you can get sick. And for what Davis was talking about, paralytic shellfish poisoning, that is caused by saxitoxin, which is produced by a harmful algae called Alexandrium catenella. So there are many different types of harmful algae. We don't usually see in the most recent documented history, although at some point maybe it might be good to visit in the past, looking at traditional knowledge, regional knowledge, place names and things like that, because I think this isn't totally a novel concept to the region, but there has certainly been a long period of time since we have seen this sort of activity. Algae is a plant. Plants need three things to grow. They need lots of sunlight, which we have, although not this week. And then they need lots of nutrients in the water, which we have, especially because we are so close to the Russian current called the Anadyr Current. And they need temperatures that they like living in. So for the most part, the algae that we usually see is adapted to cold water temperatures. And some of these more harmful algae species like hotter water. Problem is, we seem to be making warmer water. As the ice is less, right? The ice is its duration, its quality, its extent in the Bering Sea is just become less and less and less every year, it seems, with some great reduction like in 2018, crazy, 2017. So the ice, which is a whole nother topic, but the having that ice reduced, the ice is unable to replenish the thermal curtain that separates the two completely distinct ecosystems of the Southern Bering Sea and the Northern Bering Sea. So because of that, so many things from the south are moving north. And as everyone knows, right, our water whooshes north through the Bering Strait. So we're sucking sort of all things up to the north. Some of the things we're sucking up from the north are some of these algae that like warmer water, and they are finding warmer water now. Is that what triggers the cells to start splitting? Nobody has figured that out yet. But one of the things that was to be an emerging, like, oh my gosh, this may be headed our way, is a harmful algal bloom event. That meaning that the type of algae from the south that likes warmer water and is kind of around sometimes in our waters in very low number has found conditions that make it want to grow really fast. So unfortunately, we have had in the Bering Strait region right on up the coast quite a research vessel, actually. And the research vessel, the Norseman II, has got a bunch of people on it. And those people are from all over. Some are from University of Alaska Fairbanks here in Alaska. Some are from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts, all over. And the whole cruise was dedicated to looking at sort of forward thinking and trying to catch and understand, do we have saxitoxin in the water? Do we have the Alexandrium catenella? They're just sort of focused on a very few types of harmful algae. And I think for the purposes today, we're talking about Alexandrium catenella.
Yep, you got it, Gay. Quick follow-up on that. Yeah, because you're kind of getting into now the information that was released in conjunction with Norton Sound Health Corporation, right? And this was recently, like within the last couple weeks. Yeah. What kind of stood out to you about that announcement? I mean, seeing the levels of the Alexandrium catenella.
Two things stood out. One, the cell counts. So my understanding is, and I'm not a harmful algal bloom pro, but the cell counts are higher than anticipated. They were, I don't want to say they weren't unexpected, you know, but I think that this was going on this year seemed for them to document it right now. Gosh, not much time to get ready. We went from just learning about harmful algal bloom to responding to one. That's difficult. That's very difficult. So the first thing was, yes, it was unexpected. Yes, the levels of the cell counts, the amount of Alexandrium they were finding west of Gamble, right on the border, north of Shishmaref, near right at Diomede's back door. All of those things were shocking, very high, and we're standing by to get the results back as soon as the ship comes in. They'll send their samples off to the lab, and we'll find out how toxic was the water. Maybe it was just – maybe we dodged a bullet. Maybe we didn't. We don't know. So that was shocking. The other thing is and I think we should harp back to it at some point, is the traditional knowledge and the way people prepare foods, other things to do with place names have helped save people from getting ill. But there's a lot that needs to be done in this region as far as monitoring. And the thing that was most amazing was the ability, because these researchers on this particular vessel had been integrating into the existing communication network of the Bering Strait region. So they had already been working with Norton Sound Health Corporation. They had reached out and been working a little bit with me. I don't think we anticipated all of this unfolding by any means. But because of that and because they were on a boat, the local response, the Norton Sound Health Corporation was able to alert all the clinics in the region. They have, with Emma Pate in the Office of Environmental Health, Emma Pate and Rachel Lee have a seawater sampling program that they are trying to stand up in this region. And if any of the communities are interested, I encourage people to contact the Norton Sound Health Corporation. And I think Emma Pate is going to be one of your guests coming up.
Yay, and I want to chime in right here, because if you have questions about harmful algae blooms, text them to us at 907-317-7052, your name and location. Text us your questions. Again, we're unwrapping the science of harmful algae blooms that have been emerging, and there was a recent alert to our region's communities to the threat of paralytic shellfish poisoning, which can occur when people eat clams, crabs, or stomach content of walrus that might have been exposed to the toxin. So this is a new biological and chemical threat to our region. So, and the science is still sort of ongoing. Gay, I understand you were part of a EcoHab monitoring project studying how harmful algae bloom toxins are impacting the food web in the Arctic. Can you tell us a little bit about what you are studying and how, at what level do these toxins become a threat to human health?
So, I should have brought the human health. I don't have that number right on me. 80 micrograms. Okay. So there's two things with this cruise. One is there are people that are testing the water on the ship. There's also so they're trying to do their amount of research from the Northern Bering Sea to the Beaufort Sea, trying to understand what kinds of harmful algae are they likely to find, how much is in the waters, that sort of thing. Norton Sound Health Corporation is trying to do a seawater monitoring project. So that's a long-term, like having our own dew line system throughout the region to give us some indication when or not the algae is at a high level, what kinds of algae. Like if it's all good algae at a high level, bring it on. That's good for the animals. If it's harmful algae, then maybe we want to be put out a message to people to be cautious. The project I'm working with is with also more a research project. And from the research side of the house, joining with Emma, who's doing a monitoring project, we're kind of getting at the problem of harmful algae occurrence in the Bering Strait region and further north. We're all attacking the problem at different levels. The boat, the EcoHab food web study, and then monitoring. So this is really dynamic. The part I'm involved in is looking is a 5-year project to look at how saxitoxin's moving through the food web. Saxitoxin and another toxin that we haven't talked about, and I won't get into it. It's not a threat at this time, but domoic acid. So seafoods such as upa, tunicates, crab, any of the seals that eat crab or clam, walruses, how is it going through what's in the food web? At certain levels with the water, what do you find in the animals? So right now, since we are in a response and we are doing research and everyone is luckily carrying each other and working together on this, you know, if people have concerns about their seafood, they should get in touch with their tribal office and get samples in. The tribal office can call Emma Pate because that's a response, right? People are worried for their food. For the research arm of it, if you harvest a seal, seabird, whatnot, we're looking for 2 feet of intestine from down near the anus, uncleaned. Again, contact your tribal office. I think Fish and Game is still collecting, although we're having – anyway, there's sometimes collecting the intestines as well. But that is what we need in this region is 2 feet of intestine uncleaned. We'll clean out the feces here in the lab or the UNUC, and we will send that off to be tested. So the research project is looking for a lot of the same seafoods, and we are sharing that information. But because the harmful algae has been in the area recently at such a high level, right now I would say send those seafoods in, and there is money that just showed up to get them rapidly tested somewhere else. But because we will all share the data, it's a little complicated because, again, what would be easy to explain as a project has been confounded by we are kind of in a response trying to get information quickly back to communities. So I encourage people to, if you're worried about your seafood, call the – I'm sure they're going to give the number here for Emma Pate and also my number, and have your tribal coordinator or your tribal council give us a call, either number, and we would be ready to receive.
Well, we're tracking down that number. I'm going to give another shout-out for who makes some really good dry fish. This is from Daniel Pascoia. He's giving a shout-out to Martha Noyakook of Teller, Cooper Pascoia, Cameron Pascoia, Benny Pascoia, and Megan Pascoia. Yum. That sounds like a lot of dry fish.
That does. I do have Emma Pate's number to share, so thank you for the shout-out there, Gay, that you gave. So, yeah, Emma Pate, she's the training coordinator and environmental planner technically with the IGAP program, but also works with the Office of Environmental Health at Norton Sound. Her number is 443-3308. Again, that's 907-443-3308. And it looks like we're kind of getting towards the end of the show, Gay, but I just want to go back to the second part of Megan's last question there, which was about the level of toxins that affect human health. And you mentioned the specific microgram number there. But as we've discussed at length at different times over the last couple of years, how do you kind of put this into context for human health? I mean, there isn't quite a federal standard or any standard really related to that level, correct?
It's incredibly frustrating to me to learn about all this because I never was trained in harmful algal bloom, being a northern biologist, right? It wasn't supposed to happen. But a lot of what's happened in the last 20 years wasn't supposed to happen. So I can say 80 micrograms per, it's a number, right? It's just a number. That number is not actually for human health. That number that number is only restrictive for the commercial sale of clams. Mm. If the clams have the 80 micrograms of saxitoxin, I'm looking at what is it? Anyway, if it has that threshold, sorry, wasn't prepared to answer that.
That's all right.
If it is below that threshold, it is safe for the commercial sale of clams. So like a commercial fishery.
Mm-hmm.
So at that threshold, you can't sell the clams. There is no testing. All other shellfish gathering in the state of Alaska is considered, quote, recreational, which is really hard to wrap your head around when you're at this latitude. And it may work that way better for the Gulf of Alaska, but this is novel and this is the way it is for those areas. So because of it's considered recreational, my understanding is there is no money for the testing of clams.
Mm.
There is all commercial clams are tested. Anything else, there's no money for the commercial testing of clams.
Right.
Really incredibly frustrating, as you can imagine. So there's not a lot of I'm probably the wrong person to talk about human health for sure. So you need to get someone who is better at that.
Sure.
And for the marine mammals, all of this is novel. You know, we had a walrus, Diamage harvested a walrus in 2017 about this time of year, and it wasn't acting correctly as it was reported. It was very tired, and was very unusual in its activity. And people on Diomede collected 2 feet of intestine. We sent it in on the chopper, and we got it tested 5 times over the seafood safety limit was the amount of saxitoxin in its UNUX. So it had eaten things that were very highly concentrated with that biotoxin produced by the algae Alexandrium. I asked the toxin people, you know, do we have any information on a walrus? What can a walrus take? A walrus is a tough guy and makes his whole living eating clams, not just clams, but a lot of it. And she said, there is no information. This is brand new. We have no information on what level might make a walrus queasy, much less kill it. So she did agree 5 times over the seafood safety limit is a whopping load of saxitoxin. This is a very potent neurotoxin. The toxin works by you eat it, gets into your stomach, goes straight into your bloodstream, and it heads to your head, right? And it starts messing with your ability to send signaling through your nerves to other parts of your body. Thus, it's called paralytic shellfish poisoning. And it is tasteless. It is colorless. It is, you cannot cook it out. You cannot freeze it out. It is, I think the Army tried to weaponize it. It's so good at its job. I do want to mention one thing, and that is on Friday, September 16th at 6:30, we are going to have a Straight Science with Don Anderson, who is the lead for the Norseman 2 cruise, and he's going to give results. Talk to us about that cruise. We have asked him if he could please get on as soon as possible. So he has agreed to give us all an opportunity to hear more and ask questions directly regarding the recent cruise we're all abuzz about and what were the toxicity levels in July and August. So stay tuned for that, and we'll have a dedicated Straight Science for harmful algal bloom regarding that particular cruise.
Thank you, Gay. You are a tremendous asset to our region, and
well,
we're thankful to have you here to kick off this show. This is an important topic to what we eat and making sure there's a level of safety, and we're involved in that science. And it's amazing to hear how many of our own residents and our own tribes are on the forefront of keeping our community safe. And we hope to hear more about your EcoHab monitoring project. That is the science of studying the harmful algae bloom toxins, how they're impacting the food web in the Arctic. And you are right on point with those questions. And so thank you for guiding science in that direction. As we close out here, is there any closing comments?
I would love for Gay to quickly share her number.
Sure.
So that people can contact her with those intestine samples that are very important.
Or other seafood samples. So my number is 907-434-1149. And one of the things, we're going to have storms this fall. We're going to have wash-ups of clams, wash-ups of fish. That would be an easy way to test, to send in those freight collect to Bering Air, through Bering Air to me or to, and I can get them to Emma. I encourage the region to work with what we have. We have outstanding, the Norton Sound Health Corporation is lifting up this monitoring seawater sampling project throughout the tribes of the region. We've got an opportunity with, at least for the next couple of years, with some researchers in the area, and we have them on board a boat, and they are actually willing to talk to the region. So given that, don't feel, we can take action. We are taking action. It's a local response, and it's the way we're going to do it.
Thank you, Gay.
Yep.
Well, thank you all for joining us today. We are coming at the top of the hour.
KNOM, AM and FM in Nome, it's 2 o'clock.